Tonight is very exciting. Tonight we're going to be joined by two pundits. We're going to begin the conference by talking with Joseph Matheny, who is a legend in terms of early online marketing and his work with Adobe and with other large players in the industry has been written about in textbooks. And then the second half of the hour, we're going to be talking with Ted Chiuba, who is the foremost expert on Napoleon Hill that I know of. Before we get going with this, I wanted to let you guys know a little bit about the side projects going on. As you know, that Wes Unruh has been helping me and Michelle with some of our MySpace profiles, and he threw up a MySpace profile for me just last Wednesday. And so last Wednesday, we started from scratch, and in 6 days, I have 400 friends. And if you want to take a look at it, it's at myspace.com/Howard Campbell. It actually caught the eye of Mark Joyner, and Mark Joyner has invited me on Thursday to be on his live learning event. And so if you want to catch me on Mark Joyner's live learning event, then I want you to go to the website imgoingtodothis.com. That will get you into Simpleology. It's free to register, and it has instructions there for how to listen to Mark interviewing me about what Wes Unruh has done to help me create a MySpace profile that has just gone ballistic. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce you kind listeners to one of my mentors, both in terms of writing and online marketing. He is literally, he's not old enough, you wouldn't think of him this way, but he's a granddaddy of online marketing. Joseph Matheny, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Granddaddy of online marketing. Okay, I'll take that.
I know I'm going to get a punch in the shoulder the next time I see you.
Well, you know, in internet years, I am a granddaddy, maybe a great-granddaddy. So,
exactly. I mean, you were back in the birth of the internet at like well.com and in all those early, early spaces.
Yeah, actually, even before that, in the mid-80s, I was running an antiquated piece of machinery called a bulletin board system, if anybody remembers those.
Sure, I've seen one of those in a museum.
Yeah, I used to run one. I used to have one sitting on my desk, and that's how I got involved with FidoNet, and then the well, and then through the well into the internet, and now I'm here.
One of the things that you're most known about, and you certainly have been written about a fair amount, was what I refer to as the Polaroid strategy that you applied at Adobe. And I'm not going to ask if it's okay if we go there because I've already gone here. But would you mind telling people what the strategy that you proposed to Adobe and just how easy it was to sell that idea in?
To begin with, Adobe came out of a long tradition as being a print company. Adobe was founded by John Warnock, who was one of the original scientists at Xerox PARC. And people that don't know or remember Xerox PARC, it's where it's where the mouse was born. It's where Ethernet was born. It's where the UI called Windows and Mac was born. That whole concept of pointing and clicking and doing things in an interface now that we take for granted was born in Xerox PARC. And John was there, and he perfected this method of printing things to a printer or sending a stream to a printer that looked exactly like the stuff that was on the screen. And if you remember back in the day with the dot matrix printers, that wasn't something that happened. Things looked really good on the screen, but they when they came out of the printer, they didn't look so good. And that was PostScript. And like everybody else at Xerox PARC, Xerox had this wonderful hotbed of greenhouse of things being birthed in its park, and then they would all leave and form their own companies. And Adobe was no exception to that. John left Xerox PARC with PostScript and with their blessing, and he founded Adobe and went forward. So Adobe was a print company. And in the mid-90s, they called me up. I was working at this little startup called Netscape at the time. I don't know if anybody remembers that thing.
Not only do some people remember it, but I know that Irwin Glenn is listening in, and he actually worked at Netscape in the mid-90s.
Okay. Well, we probably might have known each other if we were both at the Mountain View campus. So I was working over at Netscape, and Adobe called me up and said, we noticed that we are experiencing a spike in Photoshop sales, and at first we didn't know why, and now we're finding out that it's due to this phenomena called the internet, and we're a print company, and we know absolutely nothing about it. Will you come over and come on board and kind of guide us through the things that we should be doing? Because we don't know, we do know that we don't know, which was an intelligent thing. John's a very smart guy. And he did know that he didn't know. So he knew enough to lean back on people that did know. So they came to me and said, "What do we do?" And I out of the gate, I said, I looked at the products that they laid out in front of me, and one of them was Acrobat. And at the time, we were making about $100,000 a quarter on that product, maybe a little bit less than that. And we were selling it primarily off the shelf, didn't really have a strategy around it, and didn't really know what the product was. And so I proposed to Adobe that we take the reader part of Acrobat, we bundle it up into an installer, and we put it on the internet, and we allow people to download it for free.
Because they had been charging like $1,400 for the software.
Yeah, they'd been charging a lot of money, and it basically came bundled with the entire creation product. It was part of a suite. And you were supposed to, you know, take a copy and burn it to a CD-ROM and hand it to somebody with the PDF on it. And it was really a clunky strategy. And when I proposed that to a room full of people at the board of directors level, it was dead silence. You could have dropped the pin on the table and heard it. And they looked at me like, "We're Adobe. We don't give things away. Are you out of your mind?"
Right, because you were telling them that, "Hey, half of this $100,000 a quarter that you guys are seeing, I want to take half of that and basically give it away for free."
Yeah, that's basically what, in their mind, that's what I was saying. And so I kind of backed up and I said, you know, I had other people there with me from the division, and I said, "What we have here is a strategy to turn PDF," which at the time was nobody had heard of PDF. To take PDF and turn it into a de facto standard. And the way that we're going to do that is that we're going to take the reader and give everybody in the world the ability to read a PDF document.
Right.
And then we're going to drive demand by doing that so that we will up the sales of the creation tools. And it was very iffy, and it took us a while to convince them, but we finally convinced them that
Let
this
me
was a
back
good
up. Let me
strategy.
slow you down for a moment. So the basic strategy was you give something away for free, so that people have this reader on their system, and then as a B2B play, as a business play, you sell to the creators the ability to write into this reader.
Right, and you also drive demand for the creator, because the creator is also the editor for, so you drive demand for people who are reading PDFs to go buy the creation and editing tool so that they can edit pre-existing PDFs.
Got it.
So you turn it into a de facto standard, and the way you do that is you give it away. You bundle it with every operating system known to man, and I completely did 64 SKUs of the reader and gave it to Sun, gave it to Apple, gave it to Microsoft, gave it to Dell, gave it to anybody, HP, anybody that would let me put it on their system. I gave it to them
Okay.
for free and said, "Here's a free tool that you can include with your bundled computers. Here's a
Yes.
free tool that you can put with your games when you distribute them on CD-ROM, et cetera, ad infinitum."
And so by giving a free tool away, you were able to get massive distribution.
But at the time that I left, which was January 1st, 1999, was officially my last day there. We were distributing 1.9 million Acrobat readers per month off of www.adobe.com and ftp.adobe.com.
Got it. But the net of it is, I believe, that they wound up making an extraordinary amount of money by selling the writer.
We went from $100,000 a quarter to, when I left, we were at $350 million a quarter with that single product. And now today, that product accounts for one half of the entire revenue of Adobe Corporate.
And that comes from the power of giving something away for free to begin with, and then creating a loyal customer and creating a demand for the writer that complements it.
That's what it was all about.
Cool. You have such a diverse background, it's hard for me to pick and choose what to talk about next. But can we talk about the legend of Ong's hat?
Sure, if you want to, yeah, okay. That was a side project, and it was a literary experiment that went on for 10 years, actually.
Very good. In fact, it's still going on to this day. I mean, I occasionally see my Google alerts will pop up with a new sighting that relates to Ong's hat occasionally.
Yeah, it's still I don't actively participate anymore. I've kind of let it. I've let the culture take it and run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I did actively, you know, kind of seed it and virally market it for before it was called viral marketing, I guess. Starting I think around 1988 with the underground zine scene, and then into the early 90s with the first iteration of Boing Boing, which everybody now knows is the world's most popular blog, but believe it or not, it started out as a print magazine back in the 90s.
Hmm.
And it was run by Mark Fraunfelder, who still to this day is one of the people that run it. And he started Xeroxing it off of a Xerox machine at some chip manufacturing plant that he worked at in Colorado. And I met him through a friend and was one of the first writers for that print scene.
Now, when I came across the book, because people can go to Amazon and they can buy a book, Ong's Hat. And when I read the book, my first reaction to you when it was early on in terms of us getting to know each other, and I said to you, and I hope I don't blow anything for the readers that are listening, but I think it'll edify them in terms of the strategy that you wound up employing. But I said to you, I go, Joseph, it's a comedy, right?
Right? That's what everybody always ends it with, right? With one eyebrow raised.
And then you shared with me how you got some traction, including on the Art Bell show.
Right, yeah. And that had to do with the viral marketing scenario that I was running, which was, you know, I said earlier in this conversation that I was an early BBS haunter, and I also hosted a couple. And I used that to my advantage because back in 1988, well, when I first started doing this project and seeding it into the zines, I also recognized that there was a new form of media that was coming quick, and that was the digital media, and that at the time was in the form of BBSs and FidoNet, soon to become the internet. And so I started all along during the evolution of that digital medium. I was seeding these documents into the BBSs and then later into the FTP sites and then later into the World Wide Web as these things grew.
People were seeing this concept of Ong's Hat in different places.
Right.
When it exploded onto the scene, you wrote up a press release.
Yes.
And the content of the press release said, if I recollect it, please correct me if I mess it up, but that these Russian mathematicians had apparently disappeared into an alternate dimension, and that at the University of California, Irvine, a professor, Joseph Matheny, was inquiring into the facts because from his research it was feasible, but it had never been known to have happened in the past.
Something, you're close. And so, yeah, basically what I did is I set myself up as a person who was putting together an independent research group who was looking into the authenticity of these documents that were supposedly left behind by this group of scientists that may have traveled to a parallel dimension and left these documents behind as their scientific notes.
Mm-hmm.
And so without having ever, because if you look at the body of the story, I'm not a part of that until later. I'm the researcher who's looking into it. So I used myself as a character in my own story. And so in doing so, it was very easy for me to put together a press release, which I then dropped into the channel. And the next thing I know, I literally spent the next 4 months of my life almost every day on some radio show somewhere in the United States doing talk radio. And that included the culmination of doing the Art Bell show for 4 hours, which is around 13 million listeners, which caused my ebook at the time, which I was selling through Mighty Words. Which was eventually bought by Barnes & Noble, but it was one of the first ebook distributors out there that was started by former Adobeite friends of mine. It caused me to sell a million copies of that ebook.
And to the best of my knowledge, a million copies of an ebook is the best-selling ebook ever published.
Yep, that's a record. I even beat Stephen King, and I even beat out Arthur C. Clarke.
Right, and this is on Barnes & Noble's official list of ebook sales.
Yeah, it was on Barnes & Noble's list while they had Mighty Words. They eventually collapsed Mighty Words and kind of killed the ebook initiative altogether because Barnes & Noble was always kind of anti-ebook.
I agree, and that could be a whole nother conversation. Joseph, I'd like to introduce you to my partner in crime, Miss Michelle Chance. She keeps me honest, and she makes sure that I'm going slow enough and asking enough variety of questions to make sure that everybody is entertained and being educated. Joseph, Michelle.
Entertaining and educating, that is my middle name.
It's a long and unusual one and prevented you from having those bicycle plates, but so it goes.
Welcome. It's great to hear this interesting story about this hat.
There was a guy in a hat. Yeah, that's usually what people that see it from the outside say. But the short story on that is that what I was really trying to do is I was trying to do cross-media promotion, which eventually grew into, eventually grew into a whole new movement in gaming called Alternative Reality Gaming, ARG.
Mm-hmm.
Which basically Dave, as we both know Dave, picked up ARG by watching the things I was doing with Ong's hat and then started doing stuff around some other games, and eventually it turned into a whole genre, which Microsoft eventually used as the marketing method for launching Halo 2, one of the best-selling video games in history.
For those that are listening, this is going to be one of the most advanced internet strategies that you will come across. It's available in a book that's called This Is Not a Game. I've got a link to it on my online marketing dump blogspot. But the book is called This Is Not a Game. You can order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, local bookstore, wherever you want. Joseph, can you explain what the essence of an alternate reality game is?
Yeah, well, what we were just describing with the strategies that I was using for the Ong's hat promotion is basically what an ARG is. And what an ARG basically is – a literary project or a cross-media project that purports to be other than what it really is. In other words, it poses itself as fact when in fact it's fiction. And one of the things that is the object of an ARG in the beginning is for people to figure out that it's an ARG.
Mm-hmm.
And so once they do, they begin playing it. And by playing it, what you're doing is you're basically going across different media types looking for clues that have been seeded. And that's what I was talking about that I did with Ong's hat, is doing cross-media seeding, radio, television, print, and you gather up all these clues. And somewhere down the line, there's an objective of, when I do this, this, and this, or I have these things, I've solved the puzzle or I've won the game. And sometimes it doesn't have one objective. It has many, and it's just a time-based thing where the game will eventually time out, and some of them go for a long time. So it's a cross-media marketing strategy.
For listeners that are fans of science fiction, William Gibson, in essence, creates an ARG in his book Pattern Recognition.
Yes.
And that the lead characters are tracking down these different cross-media seeds, and that is the through line of that novel, Pattern Recognition. The book, This Is Not a Game, that our friend Dave wrote, it actually has step-by-steps on how to create an ARG as a promotional vehicle. And this is not just done in terms of tiny niches on the internet, but it's also, as you mentioned, Halo 2, that with I Love Bees was quite a large undertaking. And I understand that Dave was recently working with a national automobile manufacturer.
Yeah, he helped put together the Audi campaign called Art of the Heist. You can Google Art of the Heist, and you'll find out that it was a big campaign. I was invited through Dave to the finale, which happened in Santa Monica, California. It was phenomenal. But basically, it was this running story that happened on television commercials, in print, across the internet, all these different places where you basically there was this announcement in a newspaper and I think on television where they said that a special Audi had been stolen from the car show. Here was the VIN number. If you had any information, call this number. And that kind of started the whole thing out. And a lot of people suspected that, this is a contest or this is an ARG or this is something. So a lot of people got on the trail of this and followed it around, and it went all around the country. There was actually different events and live events that happened in different places around the country. The last one, of course, being the final piece of the puzzle, which was this whole play. It was phenomenal. They took over the Viceroy Hotel in Santa Monica, California, and you didn't know who were the players, and who were the participants and who were the people that were there just basically as spectators. Because I was there with friends and I was with Dave, I actually got to be one of the participants, and nobody knew who anybody was. The press was there, and they were walking up to us and asking us questions, and they would ask us things like, are you a player? Are you a participant? You know, and we couldn't answer them. Mm-hmm. So the press was walking around dumbfounded, taking pictures of anything they could point their camera at. It was great. It was wonderful. So the whole thing came down to, you know, you found the car and you solved the puzzle and the drama was, you know, concluded. And it was like this big interactive movie played across the country. It was this phenomenal, great campaign. And it was a financial success for them as well.
Oh, that's what's really important is for marketing to be a financial success. I'm glad that you added that. I want to take us in another direction. I know that we're going kind of all over the place or in chunks in terms of, because you've had such a diverse career, but you're probably best noted, and some of your keynote speaking has been as a media theorist. And you certainly predicted many of the adoption patterns that were seen in terms of DVD, and you're an expert in terms of new technology adoption. But you also are a meta thinker in terms of looking at culture as a whole. I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but what I'd love is your observations of what's happening in terms of media consumption and where we are culturally and what's different now compared to maybe 5 years ago, how you see us evolving.
Oh, definitely. I think maybe we've even talked about this recently, but one of the things that's been on my mind the most in the last couple of years has been the method of consumption, how the internet, handheld devices and data access devices, we'll call them, because there's PDAs and there's phones and, you know, this all kind of converging where the television is getting smarter and the computer is merging with the television and the telephone is, merging with the computer and et cetera, ad infinitum. You finally have this convergence point that everybody's been talking about and waving their finger about for years, but now we're actually seeing it happen. And George Gilder probably talked most intelligently about it years ago in a book called Life After Television, which was something I read, I think around 94 when that came out, and it just kind of bent my head. And I said, you know, I was already thinking differently about media, but now I really am thinking differently about media, and it's kind of been the tangent that I've been on ever since. And what I've been thinking about lately and noticing is that the way that text is changing, because we're still a text-based culture to a large extent. We're becoming less of one. We're becoming more image-oriented. But let's just talk about text, because we could get into all this other stuff and it would really fly out into a four-hour lecture. So just looking at text, which is, since the Gutenberg Revolution, been the driving force behind information and information technologies. And if you look at Google, Google is actually, you know, kind of antiquated in their approach, but, you know, sometimes the easiest and the simplest way to do something is the smartest way and therefore the most lucrative and profitable way. And what they did is they noticed that the number one form of content on the internet was text. You know, HTML is still text.
Yes.
And so what they did is they set up some, you know, an algorithm to index and rank text. In doing so, I don't think that they meant to do this, but they really started a new revolution in the way people access data and the way they look at data as data sets. And previously to things like Google and other search engines, but I'm just using them as the prime example. If you look at the way we access data, a data set was basically what? It was a book. And so you got this bound thing of paper, and it was a whole bunch of text laid out in a piece of paper, you know, on pieces of paper that were bound together. And the reason they were bound together is because it was a set of data that was, you know, put into chapter form and all these different things that basically said, you know, here's a subject, and here's all the data about this subject, you know, in one SKU or another that we think is most important, and here it is. And we deliver it to you in this mechanism called the book, and it's a unit. So you got the book, and you looked at the book, and you read the book, and you digested what was in the book. Now, when I buy the book from Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Borders or whoever I'm buying it from a marketing perspective, there's something I know about you, Ben, if you go to the store and you buy a book, right? if you buy a book on computers and you buy specifically about the Windows XP professional operating system as it applies to the Dell computer, I know something about you. I know something about your interest from your purchase of that book.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I'm on Google or when I'm on my cell phone and I'm accessing things through SMS text, I'm accessing data in a different way now. If you look at something like O'Reilly Safari, you're accessing data in a different way. Instead of buying an entire book, I can actually buy a page. If you go to ebrary.com, there's another system where you can actually buy paragraphs out of a book. You don't have to buy the whole book. So you copy and paste, and you're charged in a micropayment for the amount of words you copy and pasted out of the book.
Okay.
The way you're accessing that data now tells me a lot more about you on a granular level than I would have known if you would have bought the whole book. Because if you just buy the book, I know that you're interested in the Windows XP professional operating system as they apply to Dell computers, but when I watch the paragraph that you copy and paste out of it, I know that you're specifically interested in the x86 architecture and how it applies to assembly language.
Yes.
I can get much more granular with my marketing to you. I can get very contextual at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, you know, just from a marketing perspective, the way that we're accessing data and on our relationship to data gives the marketer a whole new arena and a whole new way to put relevant marketing in front of, you know, people that are out there and they're just inundated with marketing and advertising. And all these studies tell us that when somebody sees advertising that's relevant to them, they don't consider it an interruption.
Right.
They actually consider it information.
Yes.
So, you know, that's what I've been thinking about lately is how do we take this nice new technology that allows me to get very granular and very, you know, narrow and look at your level of interest in something down to a very granular level and use that as an opportunity to use to place marketing in front of you that's now more contextual and therefore, you know, something you're not going to construe as an interruption.
If listeners want to learn more about you, where can they go to learn more about Joseph Matheny?
Oh, God, I don't even keep up a webpage really anymore. If they want to learn more about me,
Google.
You can go to Google or go to AdValiant.com, which is the company where I'm CTOing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're rolling out a bunch of new, coming January 1st, we're going to start rolling out a bunch of new tools that are going to, you know, leverage all the stuff I was just talking about.
Got it. And that's AdValue, AdValue.com?
No, it's AdValiant, AdValiant.com.
You know, I had you down as working at Valiant, but I didn't. All right.
No, it's Valiant like, you know, AdValiant, like the Knights of the Round Table.
I understand now. We've got one more minute with you before we have to say goodbye because I want to honor. I told you I'd only keep you for half an hour. Michelle, do you have a question for Joseph before we let him go?
You know, I would like to say that I've come up with some brilliant question to ask, but I can't.
Joseph, as always, it is an honor and a pleasure. I hope you'll join us again sometime.
Yeah, keep me in the loop. I'd love to hear what you're up to with these calls and other things. And, you know, as always, I'm always curious to know what you're up to.
Thanks so much, Joseph.
Thanks, Joseph.
We'll talk soon.
Okay, guys, talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Wasn't that cool, Michelle?
That was very cool, Ben.
Thank you. I understand that you have two new additions to your home.
Holy cow. We can't hear anybody else laughing at us, but, you know, yes, we do. We are blessed to have now a 3-year-old and a 10-month-old.
That's fantastic.
And we're very excited about this. But just, you know, they came on the very busiest week of our business.
Of course.
And we installed a new shipping system.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired a new employee all in the same week.
You know, I'm glad that you've learned how to juggle.
Well, you know, I have to be kind of magical to keep up with you, Ben, so
speaking of magic, gentleman who we're about to speak to is known for Halo magic, or the magic of Halo. He is a gentleman that is, to the best of my knowledge, the foremost expert on Napoleon Hill. So without further ado, Michelle, I'd like to introduce you to Ted Chiuba.
Hi,
hello,
Ted. Welcome.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Keep so grateful to have you with us. Could you help us understand? Go ahead.
I didn't hear you, but I was going to say, can I correct you on one little thing before we go on?
Am I mispronouncing your name?
No, but it's not Halo Magic. It's Holo Magic, as in the Greek root holism and that kind of stuff. Holo Magic.
That's what I was going to ask you to explain is because I was Googling and first of all I was misspelling it. So if you would, magic is something that I take very seriously because to me there's nothing more precious than discovering new magic.
You got it. It is a special realm, that's for sure.
Help me understand what holo magic is, please.
Yeah, Ben. Basically, it's not as mysterious as you would think at first glance or at first impression of the word. It's referring to that quantum realm. It's referring to that realm that we can sometimes identify results of, but we can learn, therefore, how to operate it, how to input causes into it, but we can't really do it. For instance, real simple example, and this does tie in with the theme of the new think and grow rich, you take a seed. Now, we all know that if we plant a seed properly, nurture it with water, sunlight, keep the weeds away, it will grow all by itself. In fact, we couldn't make it grow. We do not have that capacity.
Okay.
It's the law of growth. Well, in the realm of acquiring wealth, in the realm of creating anything from our thoughts, we've got the same kind of magical, universal powers and principles that work if we learn how to work them.
Cool. And has that been your attraction to Napoleon Hill and the work of Think and Grow Rich?
Yes, it sure has. In fact, I started off, years ago, not even understanding the book for the first 4 or 5 years, first 4 or 5 times I read it, but I knew it was important. I knew it had something in there. And then I got into a couple of sales organizations and, of course, MLM, and, of course, they were all recommending it. So I did begin to read it deeply, and I was more really motivated then, trying to change my life. And the funny thing is, though, that what I was getting out of that book, and by the way, I had a couple of literature degrees, language degrees, so I, by this time, that is, I was beginning to be able to understand words. I was getting something out of it different from what they were getting. They were looking at it thinking it was a pure business book, and I was looking at it and saying, what? This is a manifestation manual for money or something. I mean, this is metaphysics. This is mysticism. This is spirituality. And of course, reading it more and more, I mean, that's not put in there just by me. That was what Napoleon Hill was putting between the lines.
Yes.
And as well as he could say it at that time, too, because we can speak more publicly than he can speak.
At the time, it's like, at one point he put on a list talking about how these people that he interviewed, and maybe we should need to back up and explain the premise of Think and Grow Rich. But, part of the extraordinarily wealthy and self-made people that he interviewed, they had talked about developing their sixth sense.
Yes.
And he simply put that on a list, and I understand that that was very scandalous back in the day.
Yep. That's what he had to go through, even though he – actually, the truth of the matter is, if you speak of it in public and talk about doing the same things that he was doing, some people still will think it's scandalous. But again, overall, most people will close their eyes and go on to a journey of visualization with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those listeners that are with us that are not that familiar with Think and Grow Rich, would you mind telling us a little bit of background in terms of who Napoleon Hill was and what the project he undertook was, that the result was this magnificent document, Think and Grow Rich?
Absolutely. Napoleon Hill was born, I believe it was 1883, in rural Virginia. He would have been fated to living that kind of life. He was like at 6 and 7 years old, one of the best shots, I'm talking with a pistol, in the county. Unfortunately, his mother died, and that had a great effect on him. But a stepmother then, shortly thereafter, entered his life, and really she started talking to him about, hey, you know, you've got so much more going for you. You can get out of this valley. You can become someone that people respect. You can help people. You can help a lot of people, you know, instead of bothering them and molesting them. So basically she got him a typewriter, and he began dreaming those dreams. Fast forward just a few years, he gets out of college. He's on his very first assignment, got a job, and he is sent to Andrew Carnegie's house, you know, like something like 110 rooms, to interview Andrew Carnegie on the secrets of wealth. As it was just supposed to be an interview. But that interview turned into 3 days of enchantment, of magic. Andrew Carnegie explaining a lot of what he did to get his wealth, and how he had helped other people, and how it was his opinion that these principles of wealth, even though it would take somebody, and he was offering Napoleon the job, even though he didn't offer it to him right away, would take someone maybe 20 years of their life. It would be some hardship, and there'd be a lot of doubt and not a little help and no money to receive. But basically, this should be done. And of course, then fateful thing happened. Unknowest to Napoleon Hill, Andrew Carnegie was thinking. Now, one of the traits of getting rich, because we didn't have the phrase thinking grow rich, right? One of the traits of getting rich is a person, when they have enough information to make a decision, they're decisive. No, they can make a decision. They've got enough information. He pressed a stopwatch. He gave Napoleon Hill 60 seconds to answer this question. Would you take on this project to research, codify, and present to the world the philosophy of acquiring wealth? It took Napoleon Hill 28 seconds to say yes. If he hadn't said it within that 60 seconds, by the way, what most people don't know is Napoleon was not the first one who had received the offer. Carnegie was aging, was looking for someone to pass a legacy on, this kind of thing. Napoleon wasn't the first one at all. So, but at any rate, he took it, he got it, got a lot of introductions, put in a lot of work and toil. And it was during the years of the Depression, by the way, when he was working in the White House under President Roosevelt, that he actually wrote the text to the book Think and Grow Rich. And the basic premise being, you can convert an intangible force, an intangible impulse that you have within your capacity. That intangible force is a thought. Now remember, we started this whole thing by saying there are causes and there are results. Riches are a result. So you can convert that intangible thought, desire for money, into its physical object, money. So therein, although this was also an inspiration, a holo magic night, maybe a halo magic night, the night before it was going to publication is when actually Napoleon got the title. He had actually used the phrase. He woke up in the middle of the night, you know, was inspired by it. Published in 1937, Think and Grow Rich, and real quickly it resonated with a lot of people. It had the message that you can start with nothing. You can start at scratch. There are certain principles. There is a system. There is a way. You can become wealthy. And it's sold 60,000 copies by now, and it's the book that is called the book that launched a million millionaires. And every sales organization, insurance organization, MLM that I've ever seen of is recommending it.
Mm-hmm. And now, I mean, it was a book that I came into when I came into people that thought differently, you know, that, and people that used vocabulary slightly differently, like this notion about manifesting things. Recently, it seems like the same group that talks about the attractor factor. Am I right in thinking that these would be the same like-minded people that are avid readers of Think and Grow Rich?
You are absolutely right as far as the category of people who see behind the scenes, who see what Napoleon Hill was writing. They are the attractor factor people. They are the secret people. And they are the manifesting people. Certain, you know, philosophies talk about, what does manifest mean? It means create. It means cause to happen. So, yes, and then, of course, there's still, you know, the business people, and I'm not saying they're all dumb and crass. You know better. You and I both are business people. But there are people who read it, and it has so much in there that they're reading it on a different level. from people like The Attractor Factor and Manifesting Money. Napoleon Hill never used the word manifest in his version. Of course,
okay.
2007, it's in there.
Got it. And that leads me to exactly where I wanted to go with you, and that was, how have you changed the vote? What compelled you to change these words? I mean, you're tampering with something that you hold up in such high esteem as a master work of literature. And, I mean, forgive me, but it's almost presumptuous to think that you could change it.
You better believe it is. And if you think that I didn't have those doubts, and I could hear the laughter all the way from Tennessee to California, you know, about even thinking about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But after a while, and again, you know, he had a real good run of years with the World Internet Summit, I was teaching people how to make money online. That's where this whole thing started. I was America's foremost internet marketing consultant, traveling the world. Oh, by the way, you better believe I enjoyed like crazy Joseph Mofini, your last interview.
Oh, good.
Oh, thank you. But you know, I mean, what I really saw, and I interacted with thousands and thousands, is it wasn't the methods, it wasn't the techniques, because we even got up on stage every single show, and we'd build a website, and it was always a contest. How much money can we make in 72 hours? Not once, not twice, but we did this 12 different times while I was with World Internet Summit. They're still doing the same format. And some people would go out and get it, others wouldn't. So I became convinced that, well, really, what I knew to start with but didn't quite put together, it's that intangible factor. It's that desire, drive, motivation. Began thinking, how do we build this up? How do we build this up? And so, quite naturally, Think and Grow Rich being the preeminent success book that is the most quoted and the most referred to, I started telling people, look, there's another angle to this making money on the internet. This is what you need. You need the mindset. You need this philosophy. And again, traveling the world, what really came up first off, the most obvious and blatant thing was, well, maybe a person doesn't want to be white, American male, surrounded by people they've never heard of and who have been dead for 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's what I call the editing part, which really was quite easy because, you know, I mean, sometimes it was a matter of instead of, and he must do this, you just change it to, and he or she must do this, you know.
Okay. Some of the changes that you made were more substantial than that. Like, for instance, you've got the part with the mill owner and the black girl.
Oh, yes, it was. And
do you mind talking a little bit about how you chose to make those? I hope you enjoy me engaging with you. I mean, I know that some people when I interview them, they want me to play safe, but I'm Ted.
Ben never plays safe. I'm just going to jump in. Ben doesn't play safe, so you're completely at risk and completely open when you get on one of his calls.
Well, it would be hard to get me off of safe ground when we're talking about this book. Yeah. So have at it all you want there, Ben. I'll open up.
Okay, Ben, I think you just got carte blanche, man.
Well,
have at it.
Thank you. Talk to me about how you chose to make the changes that you made and why the new changes were important to you. And it's like what you were saying earlier was changing it from being a white male-centric work to something that is more accessible to a larger population. And I'm just curious, you know, that was one instance where you made some major changes.
Yeah, and of course that's only part of it. There's been all kinds of developments in the science of personal achievement over the last 70 years also. But, you know, what I did there, again, the book talked about a colored girl, and the first time I went through it, I pulled that out because we're making it. We're embracing diversity. This is what we're all about. It's a whole new world, right? But then, of course, my mastermind partners, and by the way, if you've got mastermind partners that are very respected, then you need to follow their advice to a certain degree, you know. Anyway, they threw a royal fit. They said, you can't take that out. You can't take that out. So what I did is I put in a quick disclaimer and said, hey, we're about to talk about something that I originally left out, and the reason why is obvious because it could touch some racism overtones with somebody. But don't bloke yourself out going there. That's not what we're talking about. You know that. You know me. You've read this far in the book. That's not it. What we are talking about is a girl that was in an antique time. This was in the 1800s, who was a sharecropper, just recently been, now right or wrong, we know it's wrong, slavery, but recently been released from slavery, but sharecropper, economically not much better off.
Right.
Had no power, no authority, no education. This was a little girl. And then you've got a local business person. She needed 50 cents. She asked him. She said, my mammy's got to have 50 cents if you follow the accent as Napoleon wrote it. And those of us who know that was probably a pretty true rendition, right? But, you know, get out of here, kid. No way. Go home. She said, yes, sir. Long story short, she doesn't leave. She stands up. And then the man gets mad. Darby gets mad. He goes running over her with a barrel stave. Now, well, this is Darby's uncle. But anyway, Darby's watching this. And his comments, his thoughts are, he was thinking he was going to witness a murder. That's that status incongruity. When a young girl facing off with a white man who had the authority to kill her, the power to kill her, without any real consequence, you know?
Right. In that time, in that day and age, nothing would have happened to him.
In that day and age, at that time and place, and we don't believe that today, right? But, and so that's what I said. I said, that's what we're talking about. I want you to see the disparity. Now, what did she do when he came after her at the point of impact? She stepped forward and shouted, my mammy's got to have that 50 cents. Now, brother, we're talking about taking thoughts into physical stuff. She got the 50 cents. And mind you, this did concern money. This was a monetary issue, right? But what we're saying is, what is that attitude? Man, if you can read that story and apply that, because everybody wants to say, eh, how can you do it? You know, I've got a job. I'm only getting $11 an hour and all the other stuff. I said, man, read that story, would you? If you could read that one story, you wouldn't need the rest of the book.
Got it. Why do you say that? I mean, that makes so much sense to you, and I'm a few steps behind you, you know, maybe several miles behind you on my journey of understanding metaphysics. How does that encapsulate? What's the fractal that we can unfold? How can I learn so much about manifesting my thoughts from that story?
It's real simple. Willing to do whatever it takes. Even under the threat of death sometimes, which is usually imaginary. It was not imaginary in her case, nor was it imaginary when Pizarro sailed into Peru. I believe it was him. It could have been some other conquistador. Burned his ships behind him, looked at his men and said, men, if you want to leave alive, there's only one way, and that's forward.
Mm-hmm.
How many people approach their goals with, short of an early death, I will do whatever it takes. And usually, now we're in back straight into the metaphysical realm, usually that kind of thought has a heck of a lot of energy. It reverberates throughout the entire universe, and it happens very quickly also.
And okay. And if you could pick a number, what number percentage would you say?
A number of percentage in relation to what?
The people that have that kind of conviction, that kind of compassion about, not about, the word manifestation is tough, but about, you know, what percentage of people when they decide to say it the way that the young lady had the conviction that my mammy needs that 50 cents. You know, it's less than 1%. It has to be.
Well, Michelle, that's exactly right. We all know the statistics. And that have it that difficult or that strongly, yes. It'd be less than 1%. 3% of the population is worth approximately what the other 97% is worth. So
right.
You've got different variations, right? And 20% is worth what 80% is worth, and 5% is worth what. But when you're talking about that, that's the realm of very remarkable people. But, and again, this is another point, a major point, and I say it in the advertising, hold on. These people who have that, who demonstrate that, who pull that up from their backbone, they do not do it because they have something unique that any other human being doesn't have. We all have the same potentials, capacities. We all work the same way.
That's the amazing part, though, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Yes, it is.
It's all, we're all the same parts. You know, on the inside, it's all the same parts. It's a brain. It's a heart.
I'm just not convinced of that, though. I mean, it's there's certain people that are born mathematicians. And, like, for mathematicians, you know, there are three-year-olds that wind up solving complex math problems. And so it's like when I hear people say that we're all the same, no, we're just not.
Physically, though, Ben, I mean, you and I don't argue much, but I'm going to say physically, physiologically, we're the same. We may not be wired the same necessarily, but physiologically, we all have a brain, we all have a heart, we all have these parts, right?
And God willing, they all work reasonably well, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and we have to, yeah, we have to accept that. But by the way, Ben, what trait, what hunger, what desire, what expression or emotion of love do we not all have? How are some people different?
There's a huge number of ways. I mean, I hold that whether an infant has proper emotional mirroring is going to affect their character likely for the rest of their lives. And that if an infant doesn't get proper emotional mirroring, that they are much more likely to grow up to become narcissists and not be able to empathize with other people's emotions.
On a statistical basis, as
a particular
phenomenon, I would agree with you. On the other hand, have you not ever heard of anybody changing their whole character in the twinkling of an eye?
Absolutely. In fact, sometimes the people that have changed the most and that are the most caring and the most empathetic and the most successful came from the most excruciating backgrounds that I know of. Jeff Lloyd, a self-made multi-millionaire in commercial residential real estate in Los Angeles, a high school dropout at the age of 13, you know, beat up by, you know, five or six different foster families and horrendous stuff. It makes me shiver to think about. And his intuition and his empathy, it's like someone can come into the room and he can go up to them and say, "Are you okay?" And they go, "Thank you for asking. I just learned blankety blank." And he has a greater sensitivity than just about anyone I know. So to answer your point, Ted, yes, I know those people, and it fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and of course we really could have a lively conversation that lasted a couple of days on the differences and similarities, but chemically, electromagnetically, how we're built, how we're wired, I mean, we are all the same as far as traits, desires, hopes, wishes, disappointments, frustrations, and they're not the same. And, you know, talents and abilities, they're not the same as equally distributed. Like, for instance, unlike your friend, I would never go into math, the mathematical field. Put a dollar sign in front of it, however, it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, right on. The two things I want to ask, Ted. One is I'd love to be able to open it up to questions for people that are listening in, and I'm hoping that would be okay with you.
You got it, would be.
And then the other thing is that I've found great value in looking at the changes you've made and the choices you've made in terms of how you have modernized and the new perspective that you're bringing to Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich. What is the best way for our listeners to get your book? I know you sent me an affiliate link. Don't worry about that. What's the easiest and most direct way for people because we're going to have this audio up in different places. What's the easiest way for people to get your book?
The easiest way is go straight to the URL everybody's talking about, straight to what everybody's talking about. It's called www, of course, the new Think and Grow Rich Book.
The new Think and Grow Rich Book.com?
That's it.
The new Think and Grow Rich Book.com. That makes perfect sense. It's Napoleon's Hill Think and Grow Rich, and this is the new Think and Grow Rich Book.com. Very cool. Those of you that are listening, if you have a question, if you hit 5-star, I'll see your hand is raised, and we'd be delighted to include you in the conversation. Ted, I'm grateful to be able to have you spend so much time with us this evening. I know that your schedule in terms of speaking engagements has been very tight for the last several months. It's exciting to have this book hit the market. I'm curious there's a hand, and then I've got a question for you, but I'm going to take the hand because I want to involve the listeners as early and as much as possible. And I'm clicking on the unmute, but it hasn't happened yet. And there we go. Welcome to the call.
Hi, thank you. Ted, Do you think you can manifest without action?
Everything always tends towards action, but the answer is, depending on what degree you're talking about, you can manifest positively or negatively.
And the gentleman who just joined us, your name is?
Chris.
Chris, thank you so much for the question. When you ask, can we manifest without action, I'm curious if you could give us a little background or context for your question.
Well, I understand that some of these people, you say the sixth sense, the sort of mystical side, the sort of everything that everything comes from, that thought comes from. Thought creates your goals if they choose to be riches. So, therefore, can this be created without action, just by the act of thought itself?
I would have to say that that sounds nice, and I have heard of some Indian pundits who could do that. But it's actually counter to the whole philosophy of Think and Grow Rich, because the whole point is to use your thoughts to stimulate the universe into action towards you. But this is the law of attraction, magnetic, self-fulfilling prophecy. It's to help you, even if having a better attitude, getting up an extra half hour early is where you start so you can read success literature or something in your career. The whole point is to put you into action, because without action, you'll never get the reaction. That's
okay.
Actually, Chris, that's actually a good, very solid question, because that's one of the things that sometimes where people get stuck and they're not getting the results that they think they ought to be, and they say that, well, I'm meditating and I'm affirming, and you know, but are you going out there after that and doing anything? You know, what plan have you put together, which is principle number six, to acquire, at least to get started on the moving forward? What have you done? You know, where are you going?
Okay. Thank you.
Chris, thank you so much for your question.
Sure.
We have another question from the 215 area code, and who do we have the pleasure of joining us?
This is Michael, and good to talk to you.
Michael, thank you for joining us, and you have a question for Ted?
Yeah, Ted, I had a quick question about the oppositional nature of Think and Grow Rich. For example, if I think and grow rich, and another individual thinks and grows rich, yet we have an oppositional thought and we're both trying to grow rich, how does that issue become resolved?
Michael, can you explain to me exactly what you mean on oppositional nature of thoughts? That's where I'm kind of not in sync.
Okay. I guess that what I'm saying is that what I see is an inherent conflict in, you know, as you know, capitalism, you know, and I'm not anti-capitalism, you know, I just want to start there. But it is a competitive business, so to speak. So if I'm thinking myself and growing rich, and, you know, 1,000 other people in my area are thinking and growing rich, how is it that we can get a win-win situation instead of a win-lose situation? Because as everyone had spoken about before, there, you know, 1% of the population of the world owns the other, you know, 90%, so to speak. So that looks to me as a win-lose situation. How does this system, or, you know, the thinking and growing rich, you know, sort of, will it solve that problem? Does it address that problem? I guess that's my question, the disparity.
Yeah, that's a good one, Michael. Yes, it does address that question. And there's absolutely nothing in it that has any real competitive nature, because it's like Zig Ziglar says. He says, oh, getting to the top's easy once you get beyond the crowd that's at the bottom. But every single person can rise. That's the whole thing, can. It's about being creative. And as a matter of fact, why would you want to go out there, for instance, and try and create something that's already out in the market doing well when you could create something that's slightly different? Be creative. Express your personality. Be who you are. Do what you want, what your character traits lead you to. It's embracing. In fact, you use the word. The whole thing about it is you cannot do it without win-win. that's giving. That's and the whole thing of business. See, I sometimes say that only governments and guns steal, right? They have guns. I mean governments and thieves, right? The rest of us have to give to receive. We're persuaders. We have to give value to receive. So yes, it does definitely address that. It's just right on, and it really just says you must move beyond the competitive mind to the creative mind, and here's how you do it. You start with understanding the sixth sense, having a desire to benefit the world so that the result of riches comes, being positive, contributive. And, you know, it says you can engage in no act that does not benefit all whom it affects. So it's right on. And it really, the ironic thing about it is, you may have heard of this before, Michael. A lot of people say, I'm not unique in saying this, but a lot of people say you ought to strive to become a millionaire. You ought to become a millionaire because of the person it forces you to become.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Well, thanks for your answer. I think it was very accurate. Thanks.
Thank you, Michael.
Michael, thank you for joining us this evening. Ted, I have a question or something I'd like to read you, if I may, that a friend of mine wrote.
Yeah.
And that was, he wrote, I'm a capitalist. What other form of economy allows a person to leverage their common sense for great rewards? More than any economic system I've seen, capitalism allows the individual to stand on his own merits. One is still pushed or pulled by social advantages and political influence, but your own merits contribute more than any alternative system I've seen. Money, connections, and charisma open doors, but it's your character and wits that take you to the top. Knowledge is the application of character and intelligence. Character is the greater part of knowledge.
That is good.
And when you were speaking, what came to my mind, and as Michael was bringing up the win-win notion, what I've been, last week I was listening to T. Harv Eker talking about negotiating, and he was talking about entering into negotiation with the win-win perspective, that you don't want to smother the other person. You want the other person to win too. And what just came to my mind also from hearing you talk, Ted, is it's not just looking for win-win solutions. There's actually a third win that's necessary. When you and I do business together, it's not just a matter of me winning and you winning, but there needs to be a third party that wins as well.
You better believe it.
And to me, that's part of what you've captured in the new Think and Grow Rich. It's that respect for the hollow magic. It's the respect for that ethereal energy that's out there. And when we respect that ethereal energy, it respects us back.
Actually, the ironic thing is we are in it. And
yes.
So that is exactly what happens when we respect it and work it in a different way. You are right. It works. That's what the law of attraction is in a big electromagnetic field of the entire universe. If we transmit properly, we can then, you know, attract just no more mysterious than the unseen, but very real power of magnetism. And you follow that same metaphor, you take an ordinary chunk of metal, and it's just an ordinary chunk of metal. It has no attractive powers until you run electricity through it. Then it can have tremendous powers, that electricity being our thoughts, our desires, our dreams, our plans, our faith, how we tie it all together, what kind of decisions we're willing to make, how hard we work, you know, who we work with, the whole gamut.
So now here's the toughest question that I imagine you've been asked this week, and I know you've been doing a lot of interviews around your new book. Are you ready?
Ready.
You said I could ask you anything, because so long as we're talking about this book, you're on solid ground. Napoleon Hill died broke. What happened?
Actually, Napoleon Hill had several ups and downs. He was rich several times. Now, but Ben, I thought that he died well off by the influence and intervention of W. Clement Stone.
You know, I am not a historian, and so it's difficult for me to ascertain. Prior to you and I doing this interview, I went on Wikipedia and I did some online research in order to try and figure some stuff out. So it might have been that he was well cared for and had everything that he might possibly need. I don't know. So I'm going to humbly say that I'm mistaken here and that my question is sort of moot or irrelevant. But I was trying to be challenging.
Hey, but interesting enough, on that very topic, he did have several ups and downs. And the interesting thing about his actual approach to the book, if you read the book, nowhere in there does he pound on his own chest and say, look at me, I'm rich, I'm well off, I've done it, and this is how I did it, and this is how you can do it.
No, he talks about others.
Radically different approach. In fact, being a scholar, you should appreciate this deeply. Instead of being one man's ignorant opinion, he went out and interviewed 500 of the richest people in, at that time, America, right?
Yeah.
And got the consensus of what really happened and brought, a, for lack of a better word, an academic work to the bear. Now, he also did actually demonstrate these same things. Is having a reversal, is losing all your money, the end of the road? Not in this philosophy. It's it's an event. And he did lose it, you know, a couple times, and he did get it back a couple times. He wasn't the smartest man in the world. He also, by the way, he lost his rights to the book Think and Grow Rich, which had made him an instant millionaire. And he lost his rights because he signed them into his wife's name as an asset protection device. But then a few years later, they got a divorce, and she had.
Well, that happens. Ted, so, I want to be respectful of your time.
Go ahead.
I know that we're over the hour mark, and so I don't know if you had another appointment after this, and I want to make sure that I'd love to keep talking, provided that, that you have time.
Let's do. I'm loving it, and you're a really great host, you and Michelle both.
We thank you.
Oh, shucks.
For those that have questions, please hit 5-star, and we'd love to include you in our discussion. Michelle, go ahead.
I was going to say, hey, Ben, I raised my hand. Uh-huh. And it was kind of in response to Chris, who asked the question about, we have 1,000 of us decide we want to be rich. What happens to the other people? And actually, it's sort of a comment slash question, though, but wealth and success is not a zero-sum game.
Right.
I mean, I think that's the thing that sometimes we think, boy, if I amass wealth, then I'm taking away from something that someone else has. And that's not true, is it?
No, you're so right and perceptive. In fact, you know I'm going to talk about that for the rest of my life because you hit on it so well. It's not. And by the way, would you like an example where thousands of people have made a lot of money, a vast amount of money, in some cases millions, in some cases billions?
Sure, please.
Yeah.
And then, but before you do, make sure afterwards you tell me how exactly I follow those exact steps, right?
Well, we got to leave something to your own initiative. But look at it. The computer, the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that an arena where it didn't even exist, you know, a few years ago? Like you go, I think in the 1930s, there wasn't even a thing. And I remember in the 1960s, a computer would take up a space the size of 3 or 4 classrooms. And then along came, you know, then the military developed the internet. I remember I believe it was 1993. Could have been 94, but I believe it was 93. The very first time I ever saw an image on a computer screen. Prior to that time, it had all been just letters, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now, am I right or am I wrong? In that industry, just bringing forth one example that didn't exist, have there not been a great wealth accumulated, great wealth generated, a lot of millionaires and some billionaires without denying anybody the opportunity?
Absolutely. I would have to. I don't know, Ben. How do you feel about that?
When it gets to economics, I tend to lean towards Buckminster Fuller, and while I want to say yes, and I think that many of the people that made their billions off of computers have done better than many. Part of what was going through my head when you said that, Ted, was that some of the larger corporations have also been able to expand globally in ways in which they couldn't without computers. And what frustrates me is that some of those larger corporations have brought with them military forces and things along those lines that are denying people drinkable water. And so my only hesitation of saying yes immediately is just that some of the people that, in terms of their globalization and actually getting into other physical places, do physically restrict other human beings from what I consider to be bare necessities. And so it's tough for me to just automatically say yes, but I want to say yes because I do believe that as a humanity, that this wealth is abundance is a natural state of being, and the having the scarcity and gouging or gort, not gouging, but the obesity and scarcity framework that is out there when it comes to basic necessities is not the natural or humane way of being, and that that abundance is the natural order.
I'm always reminded of a couple of things there. I look around. I happen to live in the state of Tennessee.
Really? Now we couldn't tell that.
And there is no end to the beautiful trees, just no end. And then I go out and I fly over the ocean. I'm going to the UK, and we fly for like 6 hours over the ocean. I say, there's no end to this water. And there's been no end to the air. We, of course, humans, we'd never say we were perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reminded of that. And then I'm also sometimes reminded, well, wait a minute. Maybe human nature, we can't solve it all. I mean, there have been other great philosophers who have said that, right? But we can have a very positive impact. And if we're on the plus side of the equation, the deeper into it, the better, I'd say.
Yes. I fully agree with you, Ted. In fact, part of the reason why I'm working so hard with as many entrepreneurs as I can and as I do is that, to me, empowering entrepreneurs is the way of leveling the playing field and getting greater abundance to a greater number of people in order to spread humanity and to empower the possibility that every human on this planet is going to get drinkable water, and that it's by having individual thinkers come into their own power and that there are more people that have a mindset of abundance that we're more likely to bring this into fruition.
Well, and you and I think alike, right? We believe that we are making a difference. And isn't that what we're supposed to do? I mean, nobody's revolutionized the world before you and I came along either, right? I mean, not 100%.
Sure, not one. Yeah, and nor can I thank anyone, because it's not an individual game. This is a cooperative game.
You're right.
And that's the mindset that I think that Michael was asking about earlier in terms of competitive versus cooperative. That's the mind shift that I hope that to see in my lifetime, is this shift from people viewing each other as competition to this shift of seeing other human beings as possibilities for cooperation.
It's interesting you say you'd like to see it in your lifetime, because I bet you already are seeing that.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
I know I'm seeing it everywhere I go.
You are. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ted. That was such a beautiful gift you gave me. Absolutely. I see it more and more, and I am grateful every time I see it.
Yes.
May I share with you something that happened to me when I was 12?
Let's do it, Ben.
Thank you, Ted. It relates to part of what Napoleon Hill is saying, and for our listeners, if you've been thinking about getting Ted's book, then I want you right now to go to thenewthinkandgrowrichbook.com. Just go there and get it. You know what? You're thinking about it. You'll enjoy reading it. What happened to me when I was 12, I was fortunate, I was blessed. My mom was able to hook me up to spend 3 days interviewing Buckminster Fuller. And I asked Bucky, I said, you bring up a lot of ideas that feel heavy and dismal, and yet you're an optimist. And I said, Bucky, because he'd asked us to call him Bucky, I said, Bucky, how is it, I don't even know how to frame it, I didn't use the word frame back then, but you're an optimist. And he said, well, Ben, two things. First of all, I really don't know how things are going to turn out. And I am optimistic. I'm fully optimistic. I know that humanity has the possibility of bringing itself together to reconnect with itself in a certain way that is going to create some global type of magic going on. Now I'm paraphrasing and I'm messing up his words and I don't mean to. But what he said there was, he said there are two elements. One is that by being optimistic, that it helps create that, it helps make that, it helps call that into being. And two is, it feels better. And he said, and so long as we don't know, it doesn't make sense to me to be anything other than optimistic.
He reached that by a logical conclusion, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's good. And you know, the interesting thing is, here we are living in the results of societal movements that he helped further. You know, and again, I never like to say someone created this movement or did that, because it's so much larger than any of us, as you've already referred to. But we are in the consciousness that he helped develop an impetus.
Absolutely we are. And borrowing his technology, every time I hear someone use the word synergy, I say thank you, Bucky, in my mind. Ted, for our listeners that want to get more of you, that want to hear more of your talks, do you have CDs other than your this book? I know that you've got a book on network marketing. You've got a book on doing direct response mailing that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And book on, I'm the one who wrote the book on how to get rich on the internet.
Yeah, and we're the number one consultant flying around teaching people how to do that.
Yeah.
But do you have other audios that help that would help people get a stronger grasp of this cosmography that you're sharing, you know, from, you know, what you did in your work with the new Think and Grow Rich?
Sure do, and I do appreciate you asking. Actually, the easiest way is anyone could just go to what, you know, again, that magical word, holomagic.com, and just took the word H-O-L-O, then the word magic, put them together, holomagic.com, and I have just recently, you know, since I left the World Internet Summit, recently making that. It's a work in process today, but it is the mouthpiece and will continue to be the mouthpiece for some years to come.
Very good. I'm not seeing any more hands up, so I'm going to give a 30-second call. Unless we see hands going up, we're going to start wrapping. And with that, Michelle, you raised your hand.
I did raise my hand. Actually, if we have a moment for a personal story also, since we're talking about manifestation, I just have to share, if that's okay.
It's okay with me.
It's great with me.
It's not about wealth, though. It's not about money, but it is about me. I don't know. Actually, I don't know what it's about, so I'll share it, and you guys can tell me if I'm off my rocker and to go back to sleep. But, you know, Toy and I have been trying to start a family, and that's been something that's been on our mind for several years. And honestly, the Monday before Thanksgiving, we decided, you know, this is it. We're done. We're not trying this anymore. We're just not doing it. And on Thanksgiving Day, I was told, you know what? We want you to be the parents for our boys.
Right.
And because on Monday, we said, you know what? We're done. We're not trying this anymore. But you know what? If there are kids who need us, then we'll be open.
And
the only thing that I said was, is the only thing that I said, because I came into contact with a family member, is that I don't really understand what's going on, but I need to know how I can help. And that's how this came to be. So I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's kind of timely for this call tonight, and we've talked about manifestation a lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, so I guess my action was, how can I help? But so it's odd to me that, you know, for 3 years we've been talking about having a family, and in a matter of 10 days we now have one. You know, and so I hope you don't mind me sharing that sort of personal note about manifestation and taking some action, because I do think you have to take some action. However, my action was not the intent at the time. I didn't take the action saying, how can I help, with the belief that I would have children in a week. Let me assure you.
That is phenomenal, and congratulations, Michelle, I tell you. And it's a perfect illustration of two things. number one, you know, we adopted in this treatise every book has to have a unifying point, a theme.
Right.
We adopted money. But the principles that it teaches, the principles of manifestation, do apply across the board. And holo magic, bingo, you got it. In fact, what you had to do is get out of the way trying to solve it your way so that the universe that you had sufficiently impressed could solve it its way.
It's an amazing thing.
It is.
Ted, that was beautiful. I know that sometimes when I interview speakers, they have a favorite story or a short parable that do you have a story or a parable that you could leave us with?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
The holocosm works with psychokinesis. The supraconscious takes form through synchronicity. Now, what that is saying is that, you know, the holocosm works through psychokinesis. Psycho being mind, action, mind over matter. Let's use Michelle's example. She and her husband or mate had this in their heart and mind. It was deeply and profoundly felt. That's how you work the big picture, the universe, the holocosm. Now, the supraconscious, that's that realm, that's the holomagic realm, that's what we're wanting, that's what's in that heart and mind combined, takes form through synchronicity. It's just the growth thing. You can't make it happen. And as Michelle so well illustrates, and by the way, it could have been, I know a guy who won $31,000 in Las Vegas because he was woke up in the middle of the night a couple of days ago at an event too. Could have been something different. But it's a perfect illustration of how the universe works if we let it.
Very nice. And to get more of these thoughts and ideas, please go to holomagic, H-O-L-O, magic, M-A-G-I-C.com.
Ted, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm going to unmute the line so that those... if you would like to say thank you to Ted, we'd love to have you say thank you.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Ted.
All right, folks, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And Michelle, and I tell you what, Ben, thank you very much for having me and having the opportunity to spread this holo magic message.
It's been a delight, Ted. I hope you'll come back and join us again.
You know it.
Very good. Bye for now.
Good night, all. Good night, Ben.
Good night, Michelle.
Good night, Jim Bob. Good night, Mary Ellen.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, Ben. Good night, Michelle.
Good night, Leah.
See you next week.
See you next week. AuthorsBusinessPlan.com is proud to have presented the previous teleseminar. We hope that you're going to make the most out of this information. There are absolutely no guarantees or implied promises herein. If you'd like to get more of our teleseminars, we welcome you to AuthorsBusinessPlan.com. That's Authors, A-U-T-H-O-R-S, Business, B-U-S-I-N-E-S-S, Plan, P-L-A-N.com. That's C-O-M. We appreciate your listening. We appreciate your patronage. Hoping you're going to go to AuthorsBusinessPlan.com. Look forward to talking with you real soon. Bye for now. Have a productive night.